There's a gal that got sober in our group, and she moved to New York City, and she went to work in the sales department of the Waldorf Astoria Hotel. And in the Waldorf Astoria Hotel, they have a very unique section. It's called the Waldorf Towers. And that's very, very exclusive. It has its own entrance and its own security and its own elevator. And there are nothing but suites. And as a result, I called up Laura, and I said, Laura, I need for you to do me a favor. See if you can get a hold of all the lists of these particular years of the people who live in the Waldorf Towers. And I'm interested in two names, and I gave her the two names, Herbert Hoover and his best personal friend. And about 5 days later, she called me back. She says, David, I found it. They lived on the same floor and in adjacent suites. And this is where he learned about AA, because his best friend was asked to come to Rockefeller's dinner. And he was present at that dinner. And he also, he's the one that gave the $300. He's the only one as a result of it. And because he had some friends and some of the family that were afflicted with the illness of active alcoholism. And so as a result, television was in its infancy. And of course, this went out on the radio, Herbert Hoover's talk. And you know, there's always a bunch of drunks sitting around doing nothing. Trading real estate, drilling for oil wells, pyramiding and doing this and selling every kind of jewelry in this God's world and in the car business and then, you know, in insurance scams and everything else. And when the two words Alcoholics Anonymous came out on the radio, their ears stuck out just like jackasses eating briar, you know. And they said, my God almighty, listen to that man, he's talking about us. We're Alcoholics Anonymous. He's talking about us. Let's go up and tell Bill. Well, when Bill was alive, everybody had to go see Bill. So they borrowed somebody else's car. They borrowed some money for some gasoline and some cigarettes and coffee. And off they drive up to Bedford Hills. And they get up to Bedford Hills and they drive up there. And here's the house and here's the garage. And it's on a little, sort of little atoll. It's Bill's little house there with a big picture window and a desk. And that's where Bill used to do all of his writing. And I've been up there many, many times, and I've sat at Bill's desk, and I managed to look out the window, and now I can understand where Bill got his inspiration to write the steps and all the thing about us. He could look out and see all the squirrels out there running up and down the trees, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And so the boys come in there, and meanwhile, the story had changed from the time they left downtown Manhattan till they got up to Bedford Hills. Now, you have to remember about our kind of people, we do not lie. Now, we embellish a lot and color it up, but we do not lie. And the story has changed. They run in there, and Bill said, what's up, boys? And they said, Bill, you will not believe it, but AA's best friend, old Herbert. He said, old Herbert who? And they said, Herbert Hoover. Well, Bill really didn't know at that time that about Herbert Hoover's involvement as far as that was concerned. And he said, Bill, by God, we're the only ones in alcohol. We're going to run the world. And Bill, you know, Bill was a real drunk. And when I was 5.5 months sober, a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a former delegate, early days General Service Conference, wanted to go up to New York City and visit with the old staff secretaries and go to Bill's 33rd sobriety birthday. And he wanted me to go. And I didn't have any money, and I was unemployable, and no one wanted me. And he wanted me to go. And he said to me, he says, now, I want you to make the airplane reservations. And he knew all about my pastor. He wasn't my sponsor from a sponsor. They're very close. And he said, I want to fly that airline that's got the two A's on the tail. Well, a cold chill went over me, because for the simple reason that I was physically evicted from that airline. They made a non-scheduled stop and threw me off because I attacked the pilot. Well, what it was, I was drunk, and they wouldn't, and the flight attendant wouldn't sell me any alcohol. She said, you're too drunk. And I said, and I looked down at the feet, and there was a sack, and I read that there was two quarts of whiskey in that sack. So I just pulled out one of them and started drinking. She said, you can't drink that, your own stuff. I said, you sell me some alcohol, and by God, I'll put that bottle up. You're too drunk to drink alcohol. I said, no, I'm not, now I'm drinking. Well, I'll tell you right now, here comes this man. When the captain of any airliner comes out with his cap and his coat on and walks through the cabin, look out, they mean business. He said, you put that bottle down. I said, if she'll sell me some alcohol, I'll put my bottle down. You're too drunk to be sold alcohol. I said, no, I'm not, and I drink. He reached over to grab my bottle, and when he did, I hit him, and that was a mistake. The next thing you know, they make a non-scheduled stop in Amarillo, Texas. And they throw me off of that airplane, and I'm in the custody of three men. Now, the sheriff of that county weighed about 320 pounds, and then they had a little short fella with a brush cut, hair cut, and with a mustache and a dark suit. He was an FBI agent. But the next one I was really afraid of, he was a Texas Ranger. And they took me down, they did all the usual things, you know, your fingerprints, and they looked you up and all this kind of stuff. And then they remanded me in the custody of the Texas Ranger. And his little boy, his youngest son, and our youngest son were the closest of friends. We lived in the same town, 84 miles southeast of Amarillo. And he put me in the front seat of his trooper car, and he's driving at 84 miles. You know what's worse than getting the message? Waiting to hear it. He didn't say one word for 84 miles. Got home and said, get out. You know? Well, so I had to call, and that wasn't the only airline I got thrown off. And so I had to call my sponsor up, and I said, WOSA wants to go and take me up to the Bill's 33rd sobriety birthday, and you know I can't go on American Airlines. I said, I could have gone under an assumed name, but that wouldn't be honest. And y'all trying to tell me to live the principles, and if I don't deserve it, I don't deserve to go. And he says, hang up. And he called whoever he called, and he said, you call this vice president, and I did, and off we went. And we went in there, and to tell you what kind of human being Bill was. And we went into the office, and that's when it used to be down by the East River on 45th Street. And we went in and introduced to the secretaries, and Hazel, one of the secretaries, God bless her, she's gone on now, she passed away, and she looked at me and she said, would you like to meet Bill? And I said, my God almighty, here I am 5.5 months sober. I'm going to go to the head of the mountain. And she introduced me to Bill, and this was the time that the AA way of life, or as Bill sees it, first came out in that 1967 in the fall. And he was autographing a bunch of them because they used to be about 3,000 come to dinner when he was alive, and they still have the dinner, although he's not there, and in his memory. And they come from all over the world. And I went in there, she introduced me to Bill, and his secretary, Nell Wing, was in there, and he said, now you leave, it's going to be a closed meeting among alcoholics. And here I'm sitting, Bill's, I'm sitting right in front of him. And Bill in those days, Bill never did stop smoking, he just quit buying, that's all. And Bill had a real alcoholic smoker's cough. It started his toenails and come all the way up and have an aftershock as it tapered off. And he had a long neck, and Bill, and he got to talking to me, and he said, well, where are you from? And I said, Dallas, Texas. And then he said, what group? And I said, suburban group. And when he did, his eyes lighted up. Because, you see, Bill sent through Charlie Melton, a friend who lived in New York, who married a gal who was a buyer for one of the large department stores and exclusive stores in Dallas, and he sent his friend and sponsor, Ebby, down to Searcy's, place there in Dallas that had a little rehabilitation place. It's more like a drying out joint than anything else. And he had a deep affection, and the members of the suburban group would come and visit with Ebby, and Ebby would attend meetings, and he became very close with a bunch of the members of that group. And I came into that group, and I used to hear about Ebby and all this and all that. And then he said, well, how is so-and-so? And he's the oldest sober member of the group, and those who were here last night heard me hit this member of the group and break his nose. Well, many, many years later, when I come in, he's the first one that looked down at me and said, we knew you'd be back, and I hated him, and I hated him. Found out later, he went home, and his wife, Sissy, said, well, do you have any new ones tonight? He said, yeah, that old sorry David come. And she said, how is he doing? Right away, she thought we had another fight. And right away, he said, how's he doing? And I found out, he said, well, I believe he drank too much. I don't think he's ever going to get sober. And I heard that, and that my my desire and resentment for that man increased. I just didn't care for him. I didn't like him, and he didn't like me, and I told Bill that. And Bill grinned, and he gave me the greatest piece of spiritual experience that I have ever heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, except one. And the greatest one is this. If you don't take the first drink one day at a time, there is no way in the world you can get drunk. And that is the greatest spiritual principle that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because anybody that walks around with a drunken spirit ain't sober. Mentally. That's the name of the game in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's not my opinion. That's AA's experience. And Bill looked at me and he said these words, "Son, always look for the little good in every human being, but more important, never fear their worst." That is the greatest piece of experience I have ever heard in my life. Because if you read Bill's story, you read about Bill and his ego and everything else, and setting aside and writing the principles that we have today, and people not going along with what Bill wants, that's a priceless piece of experience. And those of us who have been recipient of those kind of experiences in AA, we would be derelict if we didn't pass it on and use it. And so, about this time, and then Bill grinned, and he said these words too. He says, "You know, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't share this with you. That's all." He says, "I don't mean to hurt your feelings, but it's with love." And then about this time, we heard the clop, clop, clop of women's heels coming down the hall. It was a long hall. And Bill, the door to the office was open, and where Bill was sitting behind his desk, he could see who's coming down the hall, and my back was turned, and I couldn't see it. And Bill started grinning, and that long neck going out, so I turned around, and here comes a beautiful blue-eyed blonde. She's about 5'2", and this is not when the miniskirts came in, but the micro-minis, and she had on one of these micro-minis. And she was well enamored, and when she walked, everything on the inside of her and outside of her jiggled. And Bill and I both followed her around. It looked like we were trying to catch her rear license plate, you know. And when she passed, Bill looked at me and he grinned and he said, "Boy, AA is in good hands." And right there and then I realized that Bill was a human being. And so to go back to the story and up at Bedford Hill, and Bill even got excited, you know, and about running to work. "Can't you see a bunch of members of AA drunks running the United Nations? You turn on your television set in the morning, and this voice is shattered. I mean, this face is shattered out, you know, shattered, blocked out. And the voice comes on the out of the television. "Good morning, world. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And we're down here at the United Nations this morning at the General Assembly. And we're going to open this meeting with a moment of silence followed by the Serenity Prayer. And for those of you in the civilian world who do not know the Serenity Prayer, the words will come along the bottom of the screen and you can follow it. And afterwards, to open the meeting formally, they read a portion of Chapter 5, How This Works. And the ambassador from Iran is still having a tough time understanding how it works. We're going to ask him to read it one more time. And then after that, the topic for discussion among the nations today will be honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And we're going to ask you to return to your television sets at 5 o'clock this afternoon for a very important and vital announcement. Because we understand from a very reliable source that the ambassador from Iraq is going to take his fifth step with the ambassador from the United States." And even Bill got excited. And Bill said, "Hey, wait a minute, boy. Wait a minute here. They estimate that time, they had, what, 9.5, maybe 10.5 million problem drinkers in the world. Bill said, "Wait a minute, boy. We've got all we can do to take care of our own kind." There are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of members of Alcoholics Anonymous who have been here or here and who will come will never realize the credibility, the respect that the heads of state, governments, religion, education, professional fields have for the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. They may not have respect for some of our members, but for what AA is all about. All about. All about. And to give you some actual experiences, you know, they have the World Service meeting every 2 years. And every other 2 years, it's outside the continental limits of North America. I had the wonderful fortune to be a delegate to two World Service meetings. And they're with countries that have a general service structure and who translate and reprint our material, or AA's material, all over the world. And this was to be held in San Juan del Rey, Mexico. And about 5 months before that projected meeting, our then general manager, Bob, got a call from Johannesburg, South Africa, from the two delegates from South Africa, saying they couldn't come to the World Service meeting because Mexico had severed diplomatic relations with South Africa because of the wet and the black and the dry situation. Black and the white, rather. I don't know why I got dry. And they couldn't come. And while this conversation is going on, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous was up at our General Service office. He'd been up to the archives, and he came back down, and he wanted to say hello to Bob, and Bob's door to his office was open. Bob saw him. Bob waved him in the office and told him to have a seat on the couch there in Bob's office. So he could hear Bob's end of the conversation, but he could not hear what's going on in the other line. And when Bob finished the conversation, he turned to his friend and said, I guess you want to know what that's all about. And he explained to him how the delegates called. They couldn't come because Mexico had severed diplomatic relations with South Africa. Well, that member left Bob's office and he went back to his job. At that time, he was the second highest ranked full-paid employee at the United Nations. He didn't go back to his office. He went to the office of the United Nations ambassador to the United Nations for Mexico. He walked in and he says, I need to talk with you. He says, you know, about 4 years ago, he says, you found out I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you told me, and you were crying, that your eldest son was drunk and spaced out, thinking he was Batman trying to fly off the top of the Empire State Building, and that how much he was a source of embarrassment to you and your wife and the other members of your family, and also an embarrassment to your country. At that time, I did not ask you if he was black or white. I didn't ask you if he was atheist, agnostic, Protestant, Jew, Catholic. I didn't ask you if he was a leper. I didn't ask you if he had polka dots. I just simply asked, what was his name and where do you think we may find him? And we went out and we got him on an unsolicited 12-step call. And today, because of God's grace through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous and the freedom for anybody to be a member that has a problem with alcohol, regardless of what their background, today, he's not only a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he is a credit to your family and your country. Now, you know AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, or organization, or institution. They're getting ready to have the World Service meeting this October in Mexico City, in San Juan del Rio, Mexico. And the two delegates from South Africa called, they can't come because you severed diplomatic relations with South Africa because of the black and white situation. Is that correct? He says, yes. He said, we need to get those delegates there. He says, I'm sorry. It'll either call for a presidential citation or else the Mexican government, or through their election, their Congress, or whatever they call it, will have to pass a special law. He says, I don't care what it takes. You call what corresponds to our Secretary of State now and explain the situation. So he called. And the Secretary said, so wait a minute, this will take a presidential order. So he went in to see the President of Mexico at that time, Portillo, and he explained the situation. Portillo says, wait a minute. He picked up his phone and he called one of his best personal friends, Rudolfo, a very well-known, famed international lawyer, a non-alcoholic. He said, Rudolfo, why didn't you call me and tell me that the most prestigious meeting that we could have in Mexico, that is the general, the World Service meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, you know what I think about Alcoholics Anonymous? It's the only decent thing we have in Mexico. These people don't have their hand out begging the government to feed them and to clothe them. They're not out mooching on the streets. They're taking care of each other. And look at the influence that's happened not only in their hand, but their blood kin and emotionally attached to their children. It's the only decent thing. It's too bad our entire population doesn't live that way. And Rudolfo says, Mr. President, you've closed the banks. You've devaluated the peso. There are troops running around. I didn't want to bother you. President, hang up. He turned to his aide and says, you call the General Service office in New York City and you tell them to contact the two delegates from South Africa and you tell them to come to the World Service meeting. That we have diplomatic relations with Holland. Tell them to come in and check it out through Amsterdam and fly directly to Mexico City. They will have no trouble entering our country. They will have absolutely no trouble while they're here, and they'll have absolutely no trouble when they get ready to exit the country. Period. 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 Yeah. Now, let me tell you about Rudolfo. Many, many years ago, he attended the International Lawyers Convention in London. He sat next to a gentleman from the United States. They had casual conversation. When that session was over with, the gentleman from the United States asked his newfound friend from Mexico, how would you like to have dinner with me tonight? He said, fine, I don't have anything else to do. And they had dinner, and the next thing you know, he found himself and his friend from the United States sitting in an open AA meeting. After the meeting was over with, the gentleman from the United States asked his friend from Mexico, how'd you like that? He said, that's the most amazing and outstanding meeting I've ever been to in my life. Tremendous. He said, can we go to another one? They're better than them lawyer meetings we're going to. He said, sure. So they went to four straight AA meetings at night, open meetings. And when they broke up and finished to go back to their respective countries, Rudolfo asked his friend, when I get back to Mexico City, what can I do as a non-alcoholic if they will allow me to cooperate with this most beautiful and wonderful way of life and recovery program? He said, why don't you call them? And he did. He later became on the board as a central officer in a group office in Mexico City, and he later became chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous of Mexico. He still is the chairman of the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous of Mexico, a very, very wonderful, wonderful human being. Now, let me tell you about his friend from the United States, a lawyer by the name of Bernard Smith. And Bernard Smith came aboard on the old Alcoholic Foundation as a trustee in 1943. When Bernard died, he was chairman of the board of one of the largest banks in the world. He was also a well-respected and well-known international lawyer. He was chairman of our General Service Board and the Alcoholic Foundation for many years. He's also the architect of all of our charters and bylaws of the General Service Board, AAWS Incorporated, and AA Grapevine Incorporated, a tremendous human being. You see, AA comes with a tremendous heritage. Tremendous heritage. The old Alcoholic Foundation, you know where its office was? 34 Rockefeller Plaza, room 5600. The board, the offices of John D. Rockefeller, Jr. And baby, you can't get more high class than that, I'll tell you. No, A didn't come out of the gutter. Because God does not live in the gutter. Now run that around your head a little bit. It's God-given. And all the principles that go along with it, period. Nothing more, nothing less. And you know, in Russia, they have a tremendous problem with alcohol. Now, Russia at one time had the finest way to sober up a drunk that the world had ever known. They used to shoot them. But they were killing a lot of people, good people. And so, see, AA has been in Russia for over 40 years. The big book was smuggled into Russia one page at a time by members of AA from the Baltic countries. That's Latvia and Sweden and Norway and Finland. And who are working on construction jobs and everything, because Russia's always had diplomatic relations with the Baltic countries. They've had to, because it's the only entrance that they can get out in the North Sea to get them submarines and everything else out of there. And so they've made sure they were friends with them all those years. And because when Stalin was premier, they had to smuggle it in. He's mean. I mean, it's just like churches. Churches have always been in Russia. But anyway, so when Gorbachev became premier and a very, very liberal-minded human being, and he began, and his word began to come out about AA under the Iron Curtain, because it was very, very quiet because of a lot of reasons. And so we didn't know that they had behind the Iron Curtain, that is, on the grassroots level, because the only people that were reporting back to us were on the diplomatic level from the State Department, and et cetera, et cetera. And they would have meetings in the embassies, but not with the natives of the countries in which they were located geographically. And so at the Interim World Service meeting in Frankfurt, West Germany in 1983, in comes two members of AA, and where are you from? And we're from Warsaw, Poland. And we come, we want to translate, and we want to this and that into the Polish language, and what can we do to have start groups and structure and everything else. And so as word began to come out, because they've had AA all along, out of Bulgaria and Yugoslavia and all these other countries behind the Iron Curtain, and so they wanted to know whether Alcoholics Anonymous and God as you understand him would be subversive to the communist way of life. Well, they found out that Finland was going to have its national convention in Helsinki. And so they asked through the diplomatic channels if some members of the Russian Politburo could come and to their Helsinki, to the Finnish National AA Convention. They said, sure, you can come, but you cannot participate because you're not members of Alcoholics Anonymous. So they went, they listened, they came back to Moscow. And when they got back to Moscow, they were asked, what is this AA? And they say, it's the most amazing thing that they've ever seen or heard. What do you mean? He said, you know, those people say, if you don't take the first drink of alcohol one day at a time, there's no way you can get drunk. They said, you mean it's not the first carload? No, the first drink. Then they said, well, who pays for it? They said, you won't believe this either. He said, those people are self-supporting through their own contributions. He said, you mean the government doesn't have to pay for it? No. Then they asked, well, could it work in Russia? Openly, they said, yes. How would it work? They said, very well. They said, what do you mean, very well? It's simple. He said, you want to be a sober communist, you want to be a drunk communist. AA works that way all over the world. You see, AA had a chance to blow itself out of the tub when it got started by trying to define God in the second step. It doesn't name it. Believing in a power greater than ourselves. Naming it is unimportant. That allows a conception for each of us to believe in that power greater than ourselves, as long as it's not another human being. Yeah. That allows the Zen Buddhist. That allows those who believe in Confucius. That allows the Muslim, regardless of what it is, to come into Alcoholics Anonymous. 46% of our membership resides outside the continental limits of North America. And out of that 46%, 99% of them open every meeting with a serenity prayer, and they close every meeting with a serenity prayer. It's very offensive to try to say the Lord's Prayer in a group of Muslims. And you don't dare reach out and touch hands either. I don't mind telling you, with a Muslim, you'll draw back knuckles. Now, I've been in a lot of AA meetings and groups. At the end of the deal, if you got a watch James or some little something, to get them in kind of a spiritual frame of mind or whatever that is. And the minute they'd mention God, Jimmy Burwell would have a fit. He said, I do not believe in God. I don't want to hear the word God. I'm sober. I'm just as good a member of this group as anybody else here. And I don't want to hear it. They'd have arguments and later fist fights and brawls. And it got so bad, they couldn't have an AA meeting to talk about the common problem and common solutions. So the secretary would notify all the members of the group except Jimmy, and they would move the meeting. Well, Jimmy would find them. And they ran out of places to meet, so they didn't know what to do. So they went to Bill, and Bill, being a thinker, he said, just send Jimmy to me. I'll take care of it. Jimmy goes to see Bill, And Bill says, Jimmy, Dr. Bob and myself, we're getting ready to start an automobile polish company, and we need to have somebody to go out on the road as a road salesman. Now, Jimmy had the only really asset that the group had. He's the only one that had a car, and it was an old Lincoln Zephyr. And a car was very valuable in those days to go snatch them out of jail, take them out of the nut house, take them to the nut house, and pick up the drunks and bring them to a meeting. And the group was willing to get rid of that valuable asset just to get rid of Jimmy so they could have at least one peaceful meeting. So Jimmy went out on the road as a sales manager of a one-man sales force to sell automobile polish that never was going to get manufactured, just to get him out of New York City. Well, he got down to Philadelphia, about 90 miles south, and he did what any good member of AA needs to do if they want to remain sober and there's not an AA meeting. He went and got him a wet drunk, and the wet drunk took the bait. And they started a little group in Philadelphia, and they used to meet in a hotel, and then run a blurb in the newspaper. If you've got trouble with alcohol and you want to get fixed, it read more like a veterinarian's ad than it did anything else. Come to this hotel at this time of night. Well, there's an old gal that read it, and she was an old vaudeville kick line dancer, and a real drunk by the name of Gladys. Well, Gladys read that thing, and she comes stumbling up to that hotel, and she's had those high heel spike shoes with the thongs wrapped around her ankles and them fishnet hose and the flapper dress, and just drunker than a nine belly ghost. And she come up and she said, I'm here to get fixed. Well, in those days, they'd have a closed meeting. They'd close the door and have a guard outside the meeting, so only real alcoholics could come into the meeting. Well, oh, here comes old Gladys. I come here to get fixed. He said, you go over there. What's over there? She said, that's for them others. What do you mean others? Well, you know, wife, kid, I'm not another. I've got a problem with alcohol. And she reached in and grabbed this article out of the paper out of her purse. Are you a bunch of liars? You go over there. And she took off one of her spiked heel pumps, and she got to beating on that drunk, and she had him down on the floor. In desperation of his life, he said, lady, if you want to get fixed that bad, go on in the meeting. The guard that night on that door was Bill's sponsor and friend, Ebby. Ebby later became Gladys' sponsor. Gladys got sober, Marty got sober and went back to drinking, and right about the time Marty got sober again, they were running pretty close, she moved to Dallas, became a member of our group. Our group, Tom's been there, we've got over 2,000 members. 47% of our group are gals. And she was a tremendous influence. She allowed them gals to get in there and get on the recovery program running. And I'd have all them Red Riding Hood wolves hanging around there hitting on them all the time. And once you get sober, you can do whatever you want to. Yeah, tremendous gal. Yeah, tremendous gal. And so that was one of the bases for it. Because you see, AA found out long ago, you know, in the group that I came into, there was a bunch in there, you know, they're getting good before they're getting well. And they come in, they stop drinking, and they quit cussing, and they quit smoking, they start jogging. I've never been arrested for fat driving. I don't know about anybody else. And so they were getting good, and they had a bunch of them making goo-goo eyes over there at group and clubhouse, you know what I mean? And they said, that bunch, they're going to ruin our reputation. We got to throw them out of here. Well, what are people going to think? Well, you can't throw anybody out in AA if they're not disrupted, if they're not drinking. So they said, well, let's write Bill. So they wrote Bill a letter. Told him about these Red Riding Hood wolves in the group. Bill writes back a letter. Dear group, are they staying sober? Love, Bill. They said, Bill really doesn't understand the seriousness of the problem. So they wrote him a more detailed letter and sent it up there. Bill wrote back, dear group, are they staying sober? Love, Bill. Bill still doesn't understand. It wasn't a question what that bunch over there is doing. This bunch didn't think that's the way it ought to be. That's all. So they sat down and wrote a very lurid letter, just put anything they wanted into it just to get that bunch out of there. Sent an airmail special delivery certified receipt, return receipt requested. The letter comes back, dear group, are they still staying sober? Love, Bill. don't bother me anymore. And guess what? That bunch was so busy writing letters to get them thrown out, when they looked over at that bunch they were writing about, guess what? The problem had taken care of itself. I am so thankful that that was shared with me my first 10 days in Alcoholics Anonymous, which conveyed to me that I have all I can do to take care of my relationship with the God of my understanding and the principles of AA, and you've got all you can do to take care of your relationship with your God of your understanding and the principles of AA, and you don't need me putting my nose and messing up your business, and I don't need you messing up my business. And that's what we call in AA, live and let live. But we find in AA forces that threaten us in ways that alcohol and sex could not. Their desire for power, for domination, for glory, and for money. And you know, you're talking about common welfare. I'm going to tell you something. When they didn't have any women in AA, in the Manhattan group, and in comes Florence Rankin. She's the first gal, period, to get sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. She didn't stay, unfortunately. And she came in right when they were trying to name the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. They went through about 100-some-odd titles. They were going to call it A Way Out. And so they had a member living in the Washington, Baltimore area. Old Fitz went down there to ask him to look in the Library of Congress and see what the book, how many titles are way out. And he sent a telegram back, there's 12. That meant that AA would be 13. They thought that 13 was unlucky. Then they were going to call it the Grapevine. And the FBI found out about it because the FBI still has a magazine called the Grapevine. And the FBI didn't want to have anything to do with the drunks, and the drunks certainly didn't want to have anything to do with the FBI. Well, you say we got a magazine called the Grapevine. That's correct, but let's put the two words in front of it. Alcoholics Anonymous Grapevine. And the FBI said, as long as you put Alcoholics Anonymous with that, we'll have no objection whatsoever. They still hadn't named it. AA in those days are like it is today. We've got members of AA that drag folks in here. They haven't got any more problem with alcohol than that chandelier up there. Oh, you got trouble with worms in your navel? You got an addiction to this and that? Come on in and get flushed with this spiritual enema, and everything will be all right. Well, they were all broke. And so one of the members of the Manhattan group had a friend who had a lot of money. I mean a lot of money. He could burn all the wet elephants in Africa. But the problem was he was locked up in the lock ward in a high-dollar mental institution in Connecticut. But, if you read in chapter 5, it says, those two who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. So he said, well, if I can just get him out to an AA meeting, enough of them, maybe we can find where he is capable of being honest, and he'll reach in and get his checkbook or his pocket and leave us money in seven figures. Because he was the owner and publisher of one of the most prestigious magazines that's still in publication. Well, there was a guy old Joe out, and he brought him to the AA meeting here in Manhattan, and Bill used to sit on the floor, and he had a three-legged sewing stool, and with three legs and a circle, and it later became, in Bill's vision, what became our now infamous We Don't Own It logo, circle and triangle, and he'd take one of the legs and he'd point, you talk, and they put old Joe in the corner, and he was mumbling. Finally, he was disrupting the meeting. Bill said to the member that brought him there, your friend is disrupting our meeting. Go shut him up. So he starts over, and he gets halfway, and he turns around and says, boys, listen to what he's saying. And you know what Joe was mumbling? Anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic, anonymous alcoholic. Hey, what about Alcoholics Anonymous? The word had been used very, very sparingly in the Akron, Canton, Cleveland area, but not in the New York area. What about Alcoholics Anonymous? So in AA, if you get good, you get poor, you get well, just remember from whence our name came from. It came from a nut. We don't own anything. And everything we've gotten from somebody else. But we put it into the kind of language that our kind can understand it. Period. period. That's our common welfare. Our common welfare. Now, you say, why isn't that mentioned in A comes of age or anything else? If one would like to read the finest writing of the history of our early days in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was written by a non-alcoholic who knew more about AA than anybody that ever lived. The book is entitled Lois Remembers, Bill's wife. She knew more about AA start than any human being ever lived. You know why? Because she was sober. That's the reason why. Everything unfolded in front of her own eyes. And her memory was not clouded. And just to show you how things can get garbled, the following year, that in 68, and at Bill's birthday anniversary, and we're all in a suite in a hotel room. And Bill liked to sit on the floor. And he'd cross those long legs, and he'd have his head up against the wall, and he was telling some wild story about Alcoholics Anonymous in its early, early dark days. And Lois, the little short lady, was sitting in a chair right next to Bill. And so she interrupted Bill. She put her hand on his shoulder, and she said, Bill, now that's not the way it was. And Bill looked up at her, and he said, honey, but that's the way I remembered it. And isn't it odd that the book that Lois had, it's Lois Remembers. Yeah. And in it, it gives the titles, it gives everything in it, and it's easy reading, and it is a lot of fun to read. And so as a result, like other societies, we found forces that threaten us in ways that alcohol and sex could not. And they are all the more dangerous because they're invariably powered by self-righteousness, self-destruction, and the destructive power of anger, usually masquerading as righteous indignation. So pride, fear, and anger. These are the prime enemies of our common welfare. That's what's torn societies and fellowships apart all over the world. That's not the first time that that's happened. Men who have trod the earth, carrying in their way their views about their God and their religion. That's the one thing, and we don't do it today, but they preached that pride, fear, and anger tears up society more than anything else in the world. In AA, we call it defects of character. Resentment, selfishness, dishonesty, and fear. For, you see, those are the prime enemies of a common welfare. Because for the purpose of AA's traditional principles is to bring these forces to the top and keep them there. And only then can our common welfare be served. And only then can AA's unity become permanent. Because the preservation of AA's unity is not only life and death matter for us, but also for the alcoholic who's out there. Who's out there? Our common welfare, a lot of times, you know, in an A group, we sit there and we talk about that drunk that's drinking, you know. But what about the... I'm one of these that believes that we don't take care of our own kind within Alcoholics Anonymous. In every meeting, this weekend, they'll be here. They're here. I wonder why I'm here. I wonder, am I really an alcoholic? All the problems I'm having, my son's in jail. My daughter's run off, prematurely pregnant. My wife won't talk with me. I've just lost my job. And I go and those people are talking about all, the speaker gets up about all these great successes and it's not happening to me. Not happening to me. And we see them in every AA meeting. Their bodies in the chair and they're up there counting the squares in the ceiling. That one is just as important as the one that's out there drinking and drinking. Our job is not to add to the numbers out there, but decrease the numbers that are out there. And this old bit is, well, they'd rather be drunk than sober. When you have a mental obsession so powerful that condemns us to drink against our own will, and the physical nature of the illness condemns us to die, if we continue to drink. We've lost that choice. We've lost the choice. That's the reason we're powerless. Well, the hour's up, and we'll start again at 1:30, and I want to thank you once again for your attention and your attendance. Thank you very, very much. Hi, everybody. My name is David A., and I'm an alcoholic. And this morning, while we talked a lot about early history of AA and evolving of a lot of things and in the first tradition, and now we'll go on to the second tradition. For our group purpose, there's but one ultimate authority, loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Now, in the present printing of the Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, third edition, they have the traditions in the long form. And if one reads the traditions, you'll find that the second tradition in the long form is shorter than the second tradition in the short form. And the reason is simple, because in 1955 in St. Louis, when Bill, on behalf of Dr. Bob and the old-timers, bequeathed the entire structure of Alcoholics Anonymous to the members of AA, at the insistence of the then chairman, Bernard Smith, a non-alcoholic, that is, of the old Alcoholic Foundation. At that time, that's when the Alcoholic Foundation name was changed to the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, you know, Bill, up until the General Service Conference, us trustees, we literally ran Alcoholics Anonymous, which they did. And no one was familiar with it, and now that we're starting this new structure, because for the first 4 years, our General Service Conference was experimental in nature to see if it would really work. And they found out after the first conference that it would work, but they gave it the other 3 years because that was a promise to the members of AA. And when they finally adopted our third legacy of service, well, it was Bernard Smith who said to Bill, Bill, we need to add a line to the second tradition, that our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. And that is true. No leader in Alcoholics Anonymous, if that's what you want to call them, has that power to do that unless the members of Alcoholics Anonymous let them do that or put them up on a pedestal. And because the early AA members quickly recognized what we call in AA the power driver, a potential group wrecker, and he or she is still around, the member is always sure that he or she is always right. The member who is very happily ready to assume all the obligations of our and burdens of leadership, but very grimly and resentfully unwilling to share them or let alone give them up. But a group does need officers, and how do we cope with this dilemma? Well, tradition two is a solution. A is, in Bill's words, A is both a democracy and a benign anarchy. A group elects its own officers who have no power to order anybody to do anything. So what's the big deal if you're elected chairman of your group? It's no honor to be known as the head sick. That's the reason why in Alcoholics Anonymous we have elections. We don't want anybody to have resentful. We want to give them the freedom to be the head sick. In most groups, most of the slate rotates out of office at the end of 6 months, some, it depends on the group, and then new ones are elected. And if a group wants to be a part of the worldwide AA service structure, then it elects a GSR, General Service Representative, with a 2-year term to correspond with a 2-year term of the current area committee and the delegate. And GSRs, along with district committee members and other voting area members of the conference, elect, and then join them in electing a delegate from their area to the annual General Service Conference. And this conference is about an closest approximation to a so-called government that AA has, because it does produce opinions on important matters of policy. And it approves the choice of some trustee nominations for our General Service Board and directly elects others. But neither the conference nor the General Service Board can give orders to any AA group or any AA member. Now, when Bill was literally traveling around the United States and Canada, literally promoting our traditions, in the late 40s, hoping that they would be adopted, and they were at Cleveland in 1950 at our first international conference. They didn't even call it convention in those days. And when he got to the second tradition, talking about the group conscience, the oldest sober members in the group, and particularly those who helped found the group, got very, very upset. And they said, "Bill, now we want to tell you one thing, that my group doesn't have a conscience. I'm the conscience of the group. I'm the one that got them all sober. I'm the one that went to talk to their mothers and their fathers and the judges and the police. I'm the one that went to talk to their employers, their former employers. I went to talk to their spouses if they had one, and their farmer and their children and everybody else. I helped get them jobs. I co-signed a little note for them to get a little car. I got them from walking barefoot to shoes. I got them from rolling bugler tobacco to ready-rolled cigarettes. By God, if it wouldn't be for me, they wouldn't be sober in this group, and there would be no group whatsoever." And then as AA began to grow, the members of AA began to read the most dangerous literature you can read in AA, and that's the service manual. Now, there are three things that take care of all the problems at Alcoholics Anonymous. That's alcohol, death, and rotation. It'll do the best job you have ever seen. And they got to talking about rotation. And then they said, "Well, let's have an election. And this old timer has been running this thing all along and putting his money in the hip pocket. We don't know whether he's been paying the landlord or not, and co-mingling, what we call co-mingling in funds. We don't call it stealing in AA. We call it co-mingling of funds. And by who do they think they are? Well, the old timer, you know, he gets wind of this election and he finds out about it. And he goes to the ones he's been sponsoring and others and said, now we can't have that new bunch come in here with orange stripes in their hair, and they come riding in on skateboards. And that's that sleeping bag bunch in AA, you know, and got chains and earrings hanging out of their nose and their ear and their navel and everywhere else. They're going to ruin Alcoholics Anonymous. Now we're going to have this election, and I'm going to sit on the front row. And I'm sponsoring you, and I want you to be there, and I want everybody you to sponsor. And if you know some members of AA that the group's not familiar with, let them come and vote too. And when I raise my hand up, you raise your hand up." And that's the way it used to be until they begin to get a little bit more experienced. And so when you get to this tradition, you ask, well, who's in charge around here? We all have to remember and try not to forget that AA is a spiritual movement. And the ultimate authority is a spiritual concept of the group conscience. Its voice is heard when a well-informed group gathers to arrive at a decision. Its results rest more than just arithmetic or a yes or no count. Minority opinions and ideas get very thoughtful attention in Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the most uncomfortable members of AA are those who are attending a group, and deep down within them they know that the group is violating the spirit of the traditions. And they're afraid to ask for just a few moments to talk to the group. They're afraid that somebody won't like them. They're afraid they're going to be asked, the group, if you don't like this, go to another one. And all this, you hear in AA all the time, you know, if you don't think your group is the best one, go get you another one. Well, I'm one of these in AA that believes if you think your group is not the best group in AA, you stay there and help make it the best group. Sometimes it's frustrating. It certainly is. And ain't no sense in going to another group and help mess it up. Just stay right there. That's all. That's the name of the game. Because sooner or later, they're going to die off, they're going to get drunk, you're going to get a bunch of new ones come in. And that's how AA grows, and that's how AA always will be that way. And it'll always be that way in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God that it will be that way. And so, I've seen the minority become the majority in many, many, many instances. And what about that annoying character who always says he's right? You better listen. Just maybe this once, he or she could be right. If he or she is wrong, then he or she will, if they remember the first tradition with our common welfare, as well as the second, that they're not the boss of AA, go along with the decision of the group conscience. Does this notion seem too cloudy? Well, let's all think back to our first AA meeting. The presence that we newcomers felt in those rooms were the same as a group conscience. And it was real. They welcomed us in. They didn't set up any barriers. They didn't set up any rules. Wouldn't it be tremendous in AA today if we all treated each other as members of AA as fine and as loving as we do that brand new one when it comes to the first AA meeting. Tradition 3, the only requirement for AA membership is desire to stop drinking. Now, this tradition came about as a result of a lot of bitter experience. And a lot of groups are experiencing the violation of that tradition in all of the meetings. Not all groups, but a lot of groups do. And you'll understand what I'm talking about, I hope. We have and are very still concerned about our membership. In fact, when strong and heavy publicity first came AA's way, and even today when there's more publicity about alcoholism than ever before, the older members became scared. They used to say to themselves, well, won't all kinds of odd people show up who'll have complications, alcohol mixed with pills and other things. In the other days and even today, but we don't hear it as much, they talk about that mythical character called the pure alcoholic, no complications, just a guzzler. Well, many who came to Alcoholics Anonymous actually thought they were like that themselves. Therefore, when members begin pouring in, their worry mounted. Won't there be some mighty queer people? Won't there be criminals? Won't there be social undesirables and degenerates? They ask with a mixed certain amount of snobbishness and smugness, and this is nothing but downright fear. We simply do not know who or what's going to show up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know what? Since AA has been started, literally all kinds of people who have a problem with alcohol have found their way into AA. And you will ask, well, isn't every organization entitled to have rules for membership? Why did AA decide to forego this privilege to be all-inclusive and not exclusive? And that's simple. Early members tried it the other way, and it did not work. And as our fellowship neared its 10-year mark, our office, which was then asked at our headquarters, asked that the groups list their membership rules and send them all in. And if you ever have a chance to read the rules that a lot of groups used to have in Alcoholics Anonymous to be a member, it's very, very interesting and very, very funny and very, very entertaining. And if all of those rules had been in effect everywhere at Alcoholics Anonymous at the same time, it would have been practically impossible for any alcoholic to become a member of AA. Our two co-founders, Bill and Dr. Bob, if the rules were in effect, could not be members of Alcoholics Anonymous. If one reads Bill's story, it's alcohol and sedatives. Dr. Bob's story is alcohol and barbiturates. But neither one of them called themselves an alcoholic and an addict or an alcoholic and this or that. Just an alcoholic. In fact, Lois never called Bill an alcoholic. Called him a drunk. And when Bill would come off of his trip, she'd ask him, she'd say, how are the drunks doing? And Bill would explain to her the progress or lesser progress. And so also about 90% of our oldest members could never have gotten by. So the rule books were thrown out and replaced by one simple, complicated sentence. Tradition 3. Well, then somebody may ask, well, this tradition itself is a rule. It does state one requirement for membership. Well, let's read it again. The only requirement for AA membership is desire to stop drinking, and it doesn't mean, well, it's grape juice either. Well, you know what? Now, who in Alcoholics Anonymous, in any group, any place, anywhere, has been designated or qualified to determine whether or not a newcomer qualifies, whether he or she wants to stop drinking? I've been in AA groups over half of this world, and I've never been in an AA group or anywhere where they've got an instrument that they stick up, in, down, and through an alcoholic to see how alcoholic they are, if they want to stay sober or if they want to go back to drinking. Obviously, no one except the newcomer himself. Everybody else has simply have to take their word for it. That's one of the reasons that they read a portion of chapter 5 when it says, if you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. As much as we want to do it for someone else, we cannot do it. As much as all we can do is share our own experience. The new one has to say, yes, yes, yes. In fact, you don't even have to say it aloud. And that's fortunate for many of us who arrive today with only a half-hearted desire to stay sober. We are alive because the AA Road stayed open for us. And you know, I like to use experiences, reason these traditions came about. And this is a very interesting experience, how the third tradition evolved. In the old 23rd Street Clubhouse on 24th Street in New York City, now that's typical of AA, naming a group. Barry was on the desk, and the door opened, and two policemen come dragging his character in, and they brought him up to Barry, and he said, "This needs to be here with you people. Jail is not going to do it for it." Now, I'm going to call this character It for a few moments. I'm going to describe It. It had on a lady's dress, carrying a lady's purse, wearing lady's earrings and a lady's hat, had rouge and lipstick on it, wearing tennis shoes, and a lady's hose, and the hair was blonde, and it was black. Barry looked at It, and it said, "What do you want to do about stopping drinking alcohol?" It said, more than anything else in the world, he said, "But man, let me tell you, I've not only been drinking gin, but I've been on the needle, and I've been on horse." Now, horse in those days, when I grew up, that was heroin. And I've been on snow and smack. Today, that's cocaine or nose candy. And I've been taking them California turnarounds and them pink and red and purple and black mollies. Barry said, "We are not interested in that. What do you want to do about stopping drinking alcohol?" And he said, "More than anything else in the world." Well, it was a clubhouse. And over in the corner, there's some rednecks playing dominoes. And they looked up and they saw It, and they said, "Get that thing out of here. It's going to ruin our reputation." Now, that bunch over to domino tables, they're what we call in AA clubhouse cripples. You know, they ain't worked in about 9 or 10 months. And they hit on all the new gals that come in, and they take money out of the coffee kitty and out of the basket and everything else. And they said, "Get that out of here." Barry said, "He wants to stop drinking. We don't care what he wants to do. Get it out." So two of them went over and picked It up, went to the door, and threw him out. Well, in those days, Bill was alive. Everybody called Bill, as I said earlier this morning. So Barry called Bill. He said, "Bill, you better go down here to the clubhouse. We got a good one brewing." Bill said, "What's the deal?" He said, "You better get down here." So Bill hops the cab. And he comes down, as he's walking through the door, he's turning around, he sees that on the stoop. He said, "What's that?" Barry said, "That's the problem." So Bill said, "Well, Barry, tell me about it." So Barry explains how the police brought It there, and et cetera, and how the bunch over there playing dominoes didn't like the looks of it, the smell of it, and they went and threw it out. Bill said, "Barry, did you ask It if it wanted to stop drinking alcohol?" Barry said, "Twice. But Bill," he also said, "that he was on the needle and he was taking pills and heroin and cocaine and all that. Barry, you know we're not interested in that. What did he say about wanting to stop drinking alcohol?" Barry said, "Two times." Bill said, "Barry, do you think he may mean business?" Barry said, "I believe that he does." Bill said, "That's all we need to know, and that's all we need to hear." And Bill went to the door and picked It up and took him over to the domino tables and said, "Boys, I want you to meet the newest member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He needs you, and you need him." And that tells the whole story. Now, I'm going to expand a little bit and talk about It. Its name was Harold, one of the finest members of Alcoholics Anonymous that ever lived. Now, Harold was a tremendous dancer. It didn't make any difference what kind of dance step he did. He could do it. And being a little light-skinned, he got a job in one of those Broadway chorus lines, and because he could dance so well and tap so well, and of course he was in ladies' rigs. And the problem was, during intermission, he'd go out and get drunk, and he'd wander around. And the last time he got drunk and he was wandering around Manhattan, in that rig that he came, that the police threw him in there, and they were feared for his life. But let me tell you about Harold. From the time he sat down at that table until he died, he never took another drink of alcohol. Now, if you read Problems Other Than Alcohol, where it talks about members who have made remarkable recoveries from both the bottle and the needle. That is Harold's story. Now, we all have to ask ourselves, where would all the members of Alcoholics Anonymous be today, those that he sponsored, who in turn sponsored, who in turn sponsored, who in turn sponsored, who in turn sponsored, if they say, no, you cannot come in, you look different, you smell different, you are different? And the answer is rather obvious. And so who are we to keep anybody out? To many a desperate drunk, AA is the court of his or her last appeal. How can we slam the door on anybody who stands outside? No, we must never do that. We must always take the risk. We don't have to worry about who comes in. The agent that forces us to come to Alcoholics Anonymous will either force us to stay or it will eliminate us. Sure, maybe our public relations will be damaged because a few strange characters are among us. Wouldn't AA be dull if we didn't have any weirdos in it? God, it'd be sickening, wouldn't it? Of course, our public relations are important, but is not the real character of our society still more important? Who of us dares to say, no, you can't come in, thereby setting himself or herself up as judge, jury, and perhaps executioner of our brother and sister alcoholic? So our experience through the years, now distilled in Tradition 3, simply says, you are an AA member if you say so. No matter what you have done or still will do, you are a member as long as you say so. Now, in the early days of Alcoholics Anonymous, they put conditions on membership. A drunk would come in, wait a minute here, you can't come to this group, you got shoes. You go to that group that didn't have any shoes when they come to AA. Look around. You're wearing a watch. You go with that group over there that got watches. And they begin to separate. We do the same thing today in AA, don't we? Yeah. I'm an alcoholic and an addict, or addict and an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic and a glue sniffer. I'm an alcoholic and a diesel mechanic. I'm an alcoholic and a lover. I'm in all that. We just can't be just alcoholics. We've got to have... I know winos in AA that wear it just like a badge, you know, God Almighty, like in the military service, you know, with degrees and everything else, and we just can't be an alcoholic. Then the tradition was written so we'd be all inclusive and not exclusive. And what we do outside of AA, in our own lives, that's okay, but when we come in here, we're a society of equals. That's all. And when we come in here, we're all spiritually sick. Real sick in some instances. Yeah. And when I say real sick, I'm describing me when I got here, not you or anybody else. And that's the reason that tradition was written, because what they were doing, they were tearing AA apart. And that's one of the reasons why it isn't the fact that they suggested, you know, women's only meetings, but it's not women's only groups. An AA group is when, and our General Service Conference a few years ago, the description of an AA group in the AA group pamphlet, it was changed. Because they were getting everything in this God's world mixed, and they went back to the old definitions of an AA group. When two or more alcoholics are gathered together for sobriety as a group, they have no outside affiliation. Period. Now, a group is free to vote on anything it wants, its meeting format or anything else. But if it starts to stray away from the basic principle of a new one who comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, or someone who's here is confused about our recovery program, they're derelict when they start diverting it away from the primary purpose of getting a little bit better and increase the chances for them to get sicker mentally than anything else in the world. And we have no license to judge, to juggle with anybody's emotions or anybody's anything else about it. We only have one story to tell, and that's our own. And so, as a result, you know, that's how it came about. And today, it's still pretty tough. And one of the reasons that it is because it isn't the principles of AA. They're perfect. Now, you hear all the time, you know, man breaks himself trying to break God's laws. Well, man breaks self because they're trying to break perfect laws. And it's the same way at Alcoholics Anonymous as a result of our experience. our kind break our own selves trying to violate and break perfect principles. And I've had many, many ask me, David, you seem to be reasonably and very comfortable with the recovery program principles of AA. And I said, yes, I am. And they asked me, well, what is your experience? I just simply do what the words say. That's all. Period. Period. If it says take a fourth step, I take a fourth step. If it says a fifth step, I take a fifth step. I don't argue about it, don't fight about it or anything else, because I don't want to go back the way I used to live. And I just don't want to do that. I don't want to do it. And I go to so many meetings and I see what happens to those. Yeah. You see, in AA, every member, we're all useful to each other. Very useful. More than any of us will ever realize. Because we learn how to and how not to. The one that isn't is just as important as the one in AA. It brings back home the stark reality of the active alcoholism in our life if we return to the bottom. Tradition 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting AA or AA as a whole. Now, a member who does any amount of traveling finds the AA spirit much the same everywhere. But apart from this inward kinship, there's vast differences among groups, thank God. A traveler may find maybe a few, you know, talking about the steps or the program in the back seat of a car or under a tree or in a small room. You may go to an auditorium somewhere, a hall where they got 300, 400, 500, listen to somebody in an auditorium in one part of the country, respectful silence greets the speaker and begins, "Hi everybody, my name is David A. and I'm an alcoholic." In another part of the country, everybody happily shouts back. And in many places, they introduce themselves by their full name. There are one-hour meetings, there are hour-and-a-half meetings, there's all-night meetings, there's candlelight meetings, there's barefoot meetings, there's incense and burning meetings. And in every part of the world reached by AA, the local group is free to work out its own customs. And that's how AA has spread all over the world. It's very difficult to get a group over there in Saudi Arabia to adapt exactly like a group, let's say, in North Florida. They don't understand it. But the basic principles and the tools are given to them, and they begin to work out because they have to attract their kind. Their kind. And then in time, then they realize they're part of a greater part of the whole of Alcoholics Anonymous. But always freedom brings responsibility. Now, because each step is autonomous, it's up to each group to avoid any and all action that might harm AA. How many of us realize when we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a freedom to become our own autonomous selves? I went through life killing myself. People used to say, "Why don't you be like your daddy? Why don't you be like your mother? Why don't you be like your brother? Why don't you?" The harder I tried, the worse it got, and the worse it got, the harder I tried. And I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, those wonderful, wonderful sober members of AA looked at me, and they called me boy. And I was almost 47 years old when I come to Alcoholics, and they said, "Boy." And they said, "The reason we call you boy, because you're a kid, you don't know nothing." And they said, "Boy, just be David. For the first time in life, you can be your own self with all your stinking defects of character. And that allows us to be ourselves." It certainly does. But that human computer in the mind, you know, all of a sudden we're going to be like our sponsor, exactly like our sponsor. I couldn't be like my sponsor if I stood on my head and prayed 24 hours a day for 100 years. He's he, I'm me. But together, we have a recovery program that fits each and every one of us. He can't take my full step, and I can't take his. I take it all the time. Yeah. Now, but that's just the way it is in AA. Because responsibility brings freedom. But I'll tell you, in order to enjoy our freedom, we have to become responsible. Yeah. Now, and it's up to each group to avoid any and all actions that might harm AA, and there have been such actions, or this tradition never would have been necessary. And so, in a way, the fourth tradition is like the fourth step. It suggests that an AA group should take honest inventory of itself, asking about each of its independently planned actions. Would this violate any tradition? Unfortunately, it's asked after the ox is in the ditch. And like the individual member who chooses to make the steps his or her guide towards reasonably happy, reasonable, comfortable sobriety, the wise group recognizes that our traditions are not hindering technicalities. There are proven guides towards the chief objective of all AA groups. And what's the chief objective of all AA groups? What's the chief objective of us as members of Alcoholics Anonymous? What's the chief objective of every affiliate or entity in Alcoholics Anonymous? The fifth tradition.